I am Planta on the line. This is thecommentary.ca. Adam Lewis Schroeder has been described as a young author worth watching, and his new book, In the Fabled East, is already a much-talked-about release of the spring. It is his second novel and is a sweeping literary saga set against the backdrop of French Indochina. It is said to be a rich and sensual depiction of Southeast Asia, echoing Graham Greene and Joseph Conrad. Adam Lewis Schroeder joins me now. He grew up in Vernon and has completed an MFA in creative writing at UBC. His previous books include a short fiction collection, Kingdom of Monkeys, and his first novel was The Empress of Asia, which was a critical hit. He is a columnist for CBC Radio 1 and is a creative writing instructor at UBC Okanagan. He also has a piece in Darwin's Bastards, Astounding Tales from Tomorrow. His website is adamlewisschroeder.com. In the Fabled East is published by Douglas and McIntyre. He joins me from here in Vancouver. Please welcome to the Planta Online program, Adam Lewis Schroeder. Good morning, Mr. Schroeder.
Good morning, Joe. How are things?
Very well. Yourself?
Good, thank you.
I'm interested in this interest in Asia. You're not Asian. Your wife isn't. But I read somewhere in one article that you lived in East Vancouver, and that was good enough.
That sort of helped over the years. The main impetus for, I didn't realize at the time, for the next three books that were coming, as you pointed out, all set in Asia, that my wife, who, you know, I didn't know her at the time because we grew up in different towns, but right after high school, she went and lived in Indonesia for a year with an exchange program. And then a few years after we were together, we were both kind of sick of school, so we took a year off and traveled through Southeast Asia, primarily in Indonesia, Malaysia, and Thailand. And it was a really good time for me to have gone as a writer because I was just sort of between writing degrees at UBC Vancouver. And, you know, I felt I'd kind of milk myself dry in terms of things I could write about, you know, North Okanagan orchard boyhood. So it was just like stepping through to, I don't know, Narnia or somewhere to suddenly be in this entirely different place and virtually a different time as far as I was concerned. So, yeah, it just, I guess, opened my eyes in a huge way. Just, you know, all the sights, all the smells, the history of all these places are just rife with, you know, one conquering power after another, just layers upon layers of everything that writers have always sunk their teeth into, and it seemed to be right there for me. It also helped that I was, in the first couple of weeks that we were there, we were in the Philippines. And, you know, when you first start traveling, it's fairly common for people's stomachs to not do very well. So while I was working through my bad stomach, I read heaps and heaps and heaps of Somerset Maugham's Asian stories, and that really kind of set the tone for me in terms of how you can interpolate this material into fiction and sort of sieve it through your own experience to get the richest details. I mean, I don't think there's any of my work is particularly Maugham-like, but it really sort of set the template of how it could be done.
Is it anything like Graham Greene or Conrad?
Probably. I mean, I think this one, In the Fabled East, has a Graham Greene-like quality, probably more on paper than when you actually read it. Sorry, that's a bad metaphor because the book is on paper.
Yeah.
But Greene's book, The Quiet American, is set in Saigon in 1952-53, I think it is. Maybe it's 54. But basically when the French army is losing very badly to the north, and the American CIA interests are taking the upper hand in the south, and all the various intrigues that result from that, from all the different colonial powers that are trying to get their ore in, you know, to the detriment of the local people. And there's similar stuff right at the end of my book. I don't want to give away too much, but there is sort of similar material. And I left off or even reading Greene's book as long as I could, just so that I didn't, you know, you don't want to, obviously, right, you know, take stuff straight from his piece, and you sort of, but you also don't want to deliberately avoid certain historical things just because they're already in somebody else's book. So if you can, you know, put it through your own filter first, and then it's probably safe to go and see how somebody else did it.
What sort of traveler are you? Are you, like, when you were in Asia, do you sort of like the touristy traveler, or do you try to live like them?
Well, there's only so much that you really can live like them. I mean, a lot of places, once you get out of the city, it's still very rural, you know, kind of barefoot people, you know, shucking corn under their houses while the chickens run around, which is, you know, a great way to live, you know, if the climate suits it and it suits your temperament. But it's sort of hard to step off a plane and put down your backpack, and I think, you know, you'd have to know families, you'd have to... It seems silly, but I think you need contact to be able to live like that. But I certainly am a low-budget traveler to the, you know, to a large part, especially during that year when we were traveling. We did everything on as shoestring as possible. But we did know various people, especially when we were in Indonesia, because Nicole had lived there. So we stayed with her former host family for a few days and, you know, went to mosque and ate their meals and stuff. But, I mean, we try to be as make ourselves feel as local as we can, you know, eat the local little greasy spoons and ride the city buses and stuff. And I tried to pick up as much Indonesian as I could, and Nicole's Indonesian is very good, so we could still, you know, hold conversations with people while we're waiting in bus stops and stuff. And I feel like we got a much more accurate sense of what day-to-day life is for the people living in those places than if, you know, we didn't know a word of the language and just ate in McDonald's, that kind of thing. But no, I can't claim that I really dumped myself into those lifestyles as much as I could have, but I think you'd need more time.
I was born in Vancouver and raised here, and I don't travel very much, but my parents are Filipino.
Okay.
And I was in the Philippines in January, and the view is, from a lot of people that I talked to before I left and after about my trip, is that the view of Asia is exotic. What do you think they think about us? I mean, do they think of us in the same sort of, you know, that we are exotic to them, perhaps?
Well, I think it's always, I mean, certainly everybody is probably equally different to each other to go from that culture to this. I think there has to be sort of an idea of romance to qualify as exotic, and I think, you know, from people who've read, you know, I don't know, even like Robert Louis Stevenson's Seafaring Tales or Conrad or even like the Jungle Book and stuff, there's just such a, Asia just sort of seethes with romanticism of, you know, ceiling fans and white tapis and rickshaw rides, which is great if you're in the rickshaw, but if you're the rickshaw rider, rickshaw driver, then, you know, it's at least quite a bit to be desired. So I'm not sure, certainly, you know, I just came into town from Penticton on the Canada Line SkyTrain this morning and thinking that, yeah, I guess if you're the average person coming from a different culture, you probably see, you know, how money is just sort of splashed around on anything and everything in this culture. I don't know if that's necessarily considered the most romantic thing. I mean, probably it is. I guess it all depends on what you're looking for. But certainly, yeah, I think it must feel, I don't know, I'm just sort of picturing, I don't know if you've been to Boracay off the mainland in Philippines, but, you know, this little touristy island, but also if you get back into the villages, you know, there's barefoot kids in their party dresses running around and having a great time. And, you know, I think just looking out the window where I am now, I just see like heaps and heaps of cement. Like, but yeah. I guess, I mean, Manila's got heaps and heaps of cement, so I guess it all depends on what you're used to.
Yeah. So I'm sure you're asked on this book tour what the book's about. What do you tell them?
I tell them, this may sound rehearsed, yeah. It's the story of a tubercular French woman named Adelie Tremier who leaves Paris in 1909 to go to Southeast Asia to try and find the secret of eternal life. And it's also the story of Pierre Lazary, who's a French bureaucrat newly arrived in Saigon, who 27 years after Adelie's arrival is given the job of going into the jungle to find her.
And the two stories come together, obviously.
They do, yeah. Yep.
Are you like any of the characters in this book?
Maybe. Like, Pierre has, you know, he's an academic who's taken on this bureaucrat's job for lack of anything better coming his way. And I sort of use his voice to take on, you know, because of his background, he can sort of look at things, and he's always looking for various sociological angles, and he's always thinking, oh, I could write a paper on, you know, how burnt rice is used for coffee by the street vendors of Saigon, and stuff that, you know, on 98% of other narrators probably wouldn't key into that or be nearly as excited about it as he is. So I think the way he looks at Saigon as he arrives is probably a lot like how I looked at it. Of course, it's Ho Chi Minh City now, and a lot of the more sort of old-school Vietnamese cultural details I actually got from Hanoi. Like, the old city in Hanoi still feels very intact and very authentic. I mean, that's coming from my point of view. I mean, someone who grew up there could tell you, no, it's completely different. But there's, you know, sort of street market details and beer parlor under a tree details that I have in the book describing Saigon, which I actually saw for myself in Hanoi. I couldn't find anything like that in Saigon itself.
So these places that you went to, and were you surprised that a lot of the places still seemed authentic, that they seemed intact?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're always going to go in any country, the change is going to happen faster in the cities, and certainly, you know, the financial centers are going to change faster than anywhere else. Of course, you could argue that Bay Street in Toronto has looked the same for 35 years, so maybe that argument should go out the window. But, yeah, I mean, I guess there's always outlying regions. I mean, if you go to northern B.C. or some little town by the Washington State border or something, you'll find places that feel, you know, this must be exactly as it is in the 60s. Like, certainly, I have friends who come to Penticton, and it helps that they were there on the classic car show weekend, but they thought, oh, it's exactly like American Graffiti here,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
People cruising along beside the lake and stuff, and I can certainly see that. I can certainly see that. And I think there's quite a bit of resistance to change in Penticton just because the people see that as a draw.
And so the research for this book, how long does that all take?
I guess I started it maybe 3 years ago, but that was there was sort of a couple of years of percolating, the letting the material percolate and working on other books beforehand. And I had amassed a fairly good collection of sort of translated travelogues and as much material as I could beforehand, just sort of, you know, as a hobby, if nothing else. I just love to page through the old reprints that they have of. There was a really good French travel magazine called Tour Le Monde, which was sort of the National Geographic in France of its day, where a lot of those articles have been reprinted in English. Unfortunately, my French isn't nearly good enough to be able to wade through them, but, you know, a bit of a guilty pleasure of mine is just amassing stacks of these things. And then, you know, you can always find whatever detail you need. You know, what would an oarsman on a given boat look like on a given day in 1910, that kind of thing. You can always find it on an illustrated plate somewhere. So that stuff was always sort of trickling through my head, but I didn't want to base the whole book on that. So I went to, as I said, to Vietnam and Laos in August of 2007, and just tried to soak up as much stuff as I possibly could. And, you know, part of Adelie's search for eternal life, as I put it in the little synopsis, is, you know, she ends up in a hill tribe village way north in Laos, quite close to the China frontier. And, you know, there's really nothing that I could get out of a book that I thought could succinctly capture the flavor of that place. So I went, and this won't sound like I was living like a local at all, you know, went to a tour company and hired a guide and went up into the hills on my own. Which seemed extremely splashy and outrageously expensive compared to my my previous trip, though. I mean, considering that I'd hired a guy for 3 days, it was ridiculously cheap, but, you know, all things being relative. And basically just, yeah, while I was there, just, you know, ate and drank and showered in a stream and just had my notebook handy at every single moment. They must have thought it was attached to me because
yeah.
Everywhere I looked, there was one good detail unfolding after another. And I like to think that most of the really good stuff got into the book, and I think that flavor does translate to the page as much as possible.
And the writing for you, does that come easier? It seems like you enjoyed the research process of it.
Yeah, I mean, I like them both. It's really easy to not write, so as much as you can do that feels productive and that eventually a book will come out of this that's not actually sitting in your chair and just typing for hours and hours at a time. I think most writers would agree that you take that path for as long as you can. So, okay, I finally have all the material in front of me, now I can proceed. So, I mean, I do like the actual composing, figuring out who the characters are and where they're going, but it's also relatively painful. I mean, just, you know, sitting in a chair for that long is not really a human instinct, I don't think, though I'm sure lots of Xbox gamers could argue otherwise.
Yeah. The teaching, how often do you do that?
This term is just wrapped up, and I'm feeling quite giddy about that, but it was just 1 3-hour class a week, which was the writing of the novel, so it was fairly intensive, because in one term, each student was supposed to write the main part of a novel. So yeah, a fair bit of reading and lots of thinking on how to get their characters to arc properly. And I mean, I certainly didn't approach each one as though they had to conform to any one thing, but they all had to work on their own terms and have to figure out what's working and what's not working, which you'd think would make it easier when you go back and approach your own work, but it doesn't really. It's each one is its own puzzle.
And are you always writing?
I'm always thinking about things. In the Fabled East, I probably finished copy edits and stuff last October or so, and I haven't really worked on anything too much since then. I have another novel in my brain, and I could theoretically sit down and work on it this afternoon, but whether I actually will remains to be seen. Probably July and August I'll really get going.
Yeah. And the next book, will that be in Asia?
No, that'll be set in Penticton in 1958. I kind of had to cram that last Asia trip between the birth of two little boys, births, I should say.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd be able to, in good conscience, go too far from home at this point. I may go as far over the border as Oroville, which is about 10 minutes away. That might be the extent of my travels for this one.
Yeah. Now, there's a used bookstore in Penticton where...
There is.
No, I just love used bookstores, so I'd like you to describe it for me if you could.
Well, part of the, I think, the real pleasure of going in there is that it doesn't look nearly as big when you first go in. They've taken over a couple of different businesses over the years and knocked down walls and stuff. So you go in, and it's got, you know, I don't know how many millions is the answer, but I've actually interviewed Bruce Stevenson, the owner, for CBC Radio, and he just says, I get that question all the time, and I have no idea.
Yeah.
But it's like floor-to-ceiling books over, you know, several thousand square feet. And it's not one of those bookstores that you can tell has millions of books, but they're all just, you know, in stacks on the floor. Like, it's very well organized in terms of, you know, they've got like six different headings for detective fiction kind of thing, whether how modern it is or anthologies or British or French or whatever it is. So very well organized, and it just kind of unfolds like sort of one bunker of books after another. So you go in and you go past the cache and go to the back, and there's like 10-foot-high shelves of Hardy Boys and Edith Blyton and Dr. Seuss and crazy little things. And everybody always wanders in. Another UBCO prof, Anne Fleming, and I were in there, and she was finding like strange little girls' own annuals from early, you know, from the early 20th century that she was just salivating over. And then you sort of go around another corner, and there's like philosophy and architecture and agriculture, and it's just every time you think you've reached the end of the store, you haven't. And there's, as it happens, the Southeast Asian historical narrative stuff that I usually go picking over, and which doesn't tend to move that far. Didn't tend to move much out of that store. I've been peering over the same titles that I ended up not buying 100 times over the last year, few years. And very few new stuff comes in. But anyway, I'm resilient, and I keep going back to see what's arrived. But that's way at the far right-hand corner. Probably takes about 5 minutes to walk there from the entrance.
Wow, yeah. I mean, I just said reading about it and listening to you talk about it just makes me want to go there.
Yeah, so it should.
Yeah. Are there places in Vancouver that you like?
I'll definitely go to McLeod's while I'm here, mm-hmm. Because they've certainly got very well-organized historical section, because I'm researching sort of RCMP history as much as I can for the next book, and I have a pretty good idea right on which shelf that'll be in McLeod's.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, no, I don't really have a go-to place so much. When I lived up at Knight and Kingsway years ago, there was quite a good place right around the corner, but it's since gone out of business.
The place that sold movie posters?
I don't think so. It was sort of on the north side of the street, just west of Knight, on Kingsway. I don't remember the movie posters.
I guess there are movie posters there now. I live not far from there. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Anyway, this book, In the Fabled East, is it relevant to today?
I think so. I mean, you can always... for a large part, it's about these characters. I don't want to paint any, it's not about, you know, political, historical diatribes particularly, but that was the world that people lived in, so, you know, there is, the political stuff does certainly creep in. And I think, you know, as the Western powers and, you know, first world looks at the third world, I mean, that's still going on today, and I think you can always approach that, so any historical context for that same part of the world, you can see as, you know, cautionary tales for today. I mean, we may not be that concerned about Vietnam as we once were, but, you know, you can certainly look at Central Africa through largely the same lens in terms of when our goodwill might go too far.
Adam, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Well, thanks very much, Joseph. I've enjoyed it.
I have too, and this sounds like a book that I'd pick up, so I may do that.
Please do.
Yeah, we'll do, yeah. The website for more is adamlewisschroeder.com. The book is called In the Fabled East. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. Its author, Adam Lewis Schroeder, joining me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.